From WBUR in Boston, I'm Doug Tribou, in for Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Eagles have a new number one quarterback, but will that rescue the team and its wavering head coach? Ahead on Only a Game, Philadelphia braces for the Michael Vick era. Also, remembering the Steelers-Cowboys rivalry of the 1970s and an exploration of the ways pro sports teams are beginning to take mental health issues seriously. Also, with a new manager perched in the dugout, the Baltimore Orioles take flight late in the 2010 Major League season.
You know, I was confident that it was just a matter of time before we put it all together. Starters pitching deep into games, having quality starts, and our defense has been great. We're a pretty special team, and we've showed it lately.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Doug Tribou, filling in for Bill Littlefield. It's only the third week of the NFL season, and already New England's Randy Moss has managed a miracle grab. Coach Rex Ryan has begged his New York Jets to stop embarrassing the franchise, and the Philadelphia Eagles have a new quarterback. Michael Vick was announced as the Eagles' starting QB on Tuesday evening, less than a day after head coach Andy Reid assured reporters that his starter was and would remain Kevin Cobb. Joining me on the line is Bob Ford, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Doug. Thanks for having me.
In six quarters filling in for a concussed Kevin Cobb, Michael Vick completed 63.8% of his throws for 459 yards, didn't throw a single interception, and easily escaped the Lions' blitz in Week 2. Cobb, on the other hand, struggled during the preseason, threw for just 24 yards during his five possessions as the opening week starter. So was Reed's decision really all that shocking?
It's not shocking in that a head coach's job is to put the best team on the field and do what he thinks he has to do for the team that week to win the upcoming game. Where it gets messy here, of course, is that Kevin Cobb was a tutor behind Donovan McNabb for three seasons, and now this was finally going to be his chance. He was going to be his team, and as you said, after only one half of football and one concussion, he's been replaced.
In a locker room interview on Wednesday, Vick suggested that his problems, mainly a federal conviction for dogfighting that put him in prison for 18 months, were exclusively off the field. But you make the point that he had some problems on the field, too. What's changed for Michael Vick, the quarterback?
Well, one thing that has apparently changed is his willingness to operate as a pocket passer, to wait for a play to develop. In the past, when he was playing with the Atlanta Falcons, before he went away to jail, he was much more of a freelancer, a guy who at the first sign of trouble in the pocket would take off and run, try to make a play on the run, often to great effect, but often to a negative effect as well. So if there's one change that appears to be overriding right now, it's that he looks like more of a traditional quarterback, and I don't think that's something anyone ever thought they would say about Michael Vick.
Now that Michael Vick is getting more playing time, are Philly fans ready and willing to forgive and forget his past transgressions?
Well, you'll have to tell me his winning record at the end of the season before I can tell you that, because it's very much a bottom-line decision for a lot of fans. If it works out, they're going to be willing to overlook his past transgressions, the fact that he went to jail for 18 months for running a dog-fighting ring. If it doesn't work out, I think a whole lot of people are going to turn against Michael Vick. So it really is a very pragmatic decision on people's parts. If he does well, they're going to like him. If not, forget it.
Andy Reid has said that the quarterback change has nothing to do with the Eagles' weak offensive line not being up to the job of protecting a traditional pocket quarterback like Cobb. Do you believe that?
I don't buy it entirely. I think that there's a lot of factors at play here. One of them is that Kevin Cobb is not as mobile as Michael Vick. And given the fact that the offensive line of the Eagles is fairly porous right now, they've given up 10 sacks in the first two games. You would think that you're going to give Kevin Cobb a better chance of at least staying unconcussed for another week if you have Michael Vick back there, who is more elusive. So I think that's part of it, even though Andy Reid denies it. But that's sort of the way he does things. He's not going to criticize his players. He's not going to say, I think our offensive line is deficient. But anyone who's been watching the games, that seems pretty apparent.
The Eagles have already been fielding calls about Cobb's availability before the October 19th trade deadline. Reed has said that he won't listen to trade offers for Cobb. Does that mean the Eagles are on the phone right now working out a deal?
I don't think so. For one thing, Kevin Cobb's value is not very high now, as you can understand. And I don't think he would bring very much in return. The Eagles are also into him for a $10.5 million signing bonus, which they would not get to recover any of. You know, that's all upfront money that is in Kevin Cobb's pocket. So I think right now they would have to be trading at a loss, and I don't find that likely. And given the fact that, let's face it, Michael Vick's only played six quarters of football, the way he plays the game, there's the possibility that he could become injured, and having Kevin Cobb as a backup would seem to be the smart thing for them to do.
I've seen the move called psychologically damaging to Kevin Cobb, who's merely calling it disappointing. Do you think Cobb still has a good future with the franchise?
That's hard to say because it depends on how Michael Vick plays. Everything Andy Reid says is that, you know, Kevin Cobb's future's never been brighter, which is a little bit of a stretch. From what I can tell of Kevin Cobb, not knowing him, you know, intimately, he seems like a pretty tough-minded guy. He seems like a guy who's going to take this in stride. He's got sort of that West Texas tough guy persona about him. And so I don't think he is going to be injured, you know, psychologically by this. But I can't imagine that he's very happy.
Meanwhile, former Eagles and current Redskins quarterback Donovan McNabb threw for 426 yards in Sunday's loss to Houston. Naturally, that has some people suggesting that the Eagles would have been better off if they'd just stuck with McNabb. What do you think?
Well, if you do sort of a logical progression and you say right now Michael Vick is a better quarterback than Kevin Cobb, then you would also have to say by extrapolation that Donovan McNabb is a better quarterback than Michael Vick. So, yes, that they've sort of traded down. But the organization had come to a turning point. They had had Donovan McNabb as their quarterback for 10, 11 years. They had not won a Super Bowl. There was a certain amount of civic fatigue with Donovan McNabb and a certain amount of organizational fatigue, and they felt like they had to move on. They had two guys who they liked, Kevin Cobb and Donovan McNabb, both about to go into the final year of their contract, and the decision they made was to go with youth. Does it look good right now? No, absolutely not.
Will Philadelphia develop some civic fatigue for Andy Reid? He's been with the team a long time. They've had some success, but no Super Bowl victories.
Well, there's a certain amount of civic fatigue with Andy Reid right now. It's just whether or not they sort of reached that balancing point where it tips against him, and more importantly, whether it tips against him within the organization. I think Andy has put a lot of his reputation on the line, first with the experiment to bring in Michael Vick last year, and certainly with this about-face that he's made this week to put Michael in as the starting quarterback. If it doesn't work, Andy Reid's going to be on the hook, I think, and that fatigue may become, you know, full-scale sleep.
Bob Ford is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Bob, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure, Doug. Anytime.
In 1997, the Baltimore Orioles reached the American League Championship Series and lost for the second straight year. If Orioles fans thought that was depressing, they had another thing coming. Not only was that the O's last playoff appearance, 1997 was also their last winning season. But there's hope among the Orange and Black's faithful, thanks in no small part to the arrival of manager Buck Showalter. Before he was hired, the Orioles' winning percentage was a hair above 300. Since Showalter took over on August 3rd, it's over 600. Monday afternoon at Fenway Park, as Baltimore prepared for a three-game series with Boston, the clubhouse was quiet, but the mood was upbeat. Second baseman Brian Roberts broke into the majors in 2001 and has played his entire career in Baltimore. The two-time All-Star has yet to play for a winning team.
I'm not going to say that that doesn't get difficult at times, because I think that would be lying if anybody said it doesn't. But every year I feel like we've had things that have kept you positive and optimistic. It's just a matter of getting enough of those at the same time that it starts to click and you're not really looking for positive signs. You're actually doing good things and you're really getting to where you want to be.
Showalter is Baltimore's third manager this season. He took over for interim manager Juan Samuel, who took over for Dave Tremblay after the O's opened the season with 15 wins against 39 losses. In his office in the visitors' clubhouse, Showalter says he didn't greet his new team with a motivational pep talk.
It's that famous saying, your actions speak so loudly I can't hear a word you say. So I kind of took that approach and tried to give them a little credit for knowing that the reason I was standing there is because they hadn't been playing very well.
Showalter has managed the Yankees, Diamondbacks, and Rangers, and was working as an analyst for ESPN when he was hired. The Orioles won 8 of their first 9 games under him, but Showalter's quick to credit the players and improved team health for the upswing.
I think some of them got their self-esteem back a little bit, and quite frankly, they got tired of getting beat up on and bullied around. And you know, the timing was good as far as getting 3 or 4 of the players back on the field. They've been hurt, but there's nothing you can do about the injury factor. But it's unfortunate that the previous manager didn't have those people, because I think that they would have been just as successful.
In the clubhouse, I overhear evidence of Showalter's point about self-esteem. 2 Orioles are discussing how many games they need to win to have a better record than another struggling franchise, the Kansas City Royals. The Orioles have a rich history that includes names like Cal Ripken Jr., Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson, and Eddie Murray. Hall of Famer Jim Palmer pitched for the Orioles for 19 seasons and played on all 3 of the team's World Series winners. Today, he's an analyst for the Orioles' television broadcasts. Palmer says it's been tough for former players to watch the team fall so far, and even the most loyal fans eventually started to lose interest.
It took a number of years. You just keep thinking that the club is going to rebound, and then you start looking at the standings and you realize even being over 500 with 85 to 87 wins is not going to make much of a dent in the American League East.
Outfielder Corey Patterson is in his 11th Major League season and his 2nd stint with the Orioles. Patterson says being motivated by the chance to play the spoiler to their AL East opponents like the Yankees, Red Sox, and Rays is overrated.
You know, unfortunately, things haven't gone away at the beginning of the season, but things have been a lot better the past month or so, maybe a little bit longer. So I just want to win. All this stuff about spoilers and ruining things, I just want to win as many games as possible.
Patterson is one of several productive veterans on the team, but a number of young players have also helped drive the turnaround, including rookie pitcher Jake Arrieta, who won 2 of his 3 starts this month.
Well, you know, I think what we've been doing lately is just really showing how much talent we have as a team. You know, even before I think Buck came in, we knew we were a very talented team, a lot of young guys here. I think if we just keep playing this way and try and carry it over into next year, we're going to have some pretty good momentum moving forward.
In 2009, Brian Roberts demonstrated his loyalty to Baltimore by signing a 4-year contract extension. He says the organization can't keep relying on tradition to keep fans loyal.
Tradition's great, don't get me wrong, but tradition also goes out the door 20 or 30 years later, and the team that's on the field has to win, and I think we understand that, so it's good to understand the history, it's good to understand the tradition of your organization, but then you also want to go out there and make your own memories too.
Monday night, the Orioles scored in the top of the 1st, went on to win the game, and eventually took 2 out of 3 from the 3rd-place Red Sox at Fenway. Memorable? Not really. But it's the kind of thing Orioles fans have been looking forward to for years.
This Baltimore Oreo messed around with that blackbird till he singed her wings.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Sometimes a person is born for one specific purpose. Think Abraham Lincoln saving the Union or Stradivarius making violins. Brandon Hanning was born to tackle the Ohio State mascot. And he did last Saturday before the football game between Ohio University and Ohio State. The 19-year-old Hanning was working as the Ohio University mascot Rufus Bobcat. He ran at Brutus Buckeye. Brutus shook one tackle, but Hanning eventually got his man, or Buckeye, in the end zone. Ohio fired Hanning, but it'll be hard to issue other punishments. He attended OU last year, but dropped out, and now attends Hocking College. And Hanning's not upset about losing his job. He told the school's student newspaper, tackling Brutus was, quote, the whole reason I tried out last year. I'm Doug Tribou, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, forging a losing NFL franchise into steel in the 1970s. But first, the Denver Broncos held a private memorial for wide receiver Kenny McKinley yesterday. McKinley committed suicide on Monday, and a police report suggested the 23-year-old had been suffering from depression since a season-ending knee injury in August. McKinley's teammates and team officials say he showed no clear signs of depression or suicidal tendencies. In a column for SI.com, John Wertheim examines the growing awareness and acceptance of mental illness among athletes. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks. Wish it were under different circumstances, but thanks.
You begin your article by discussing the case of Dolphins running back Ricky Williams, whose odd behavior was a running joke in the NFL for years. Williams received treatment for two major issues when he was with the New Orleans Saints: social anxiety disorder and a broken ankle. How did the team respond differently to those two diagnoses?
Yeah, he was struck by that. He was their franchise player, and when he broke his ankle, he said it was just, you know, night and day therapy. The teammates texting him, "How you doing?" There was a sort of meticulous rehabilitation schedule. Everybody cared about his progress. And when he actually had to self-diagnose himself, because according to him, the team sort of had very little interest in some of the psychological issues he was enduring, and he self-diagnosed himself with social anxiety disorder. And at some point, he finally had the courage to confront his coach and explain it, and was basically told to stop being a baby in the most profane terms possible. And he was struck by this contrast, and I think it really is a pretty good sort of reflection of sports in general, that if your injury appears on an MRI, then the team and the franchise takes note. If it's psychological and a little tougher to diagnose, then they have very little patience for it.
Williams' case is quite a contrast to the current case of Ron Artest, who says he's going to auction off his NBA championship ring to pay for mental health counseling for kids. Is that more a reflection of the sports world taking mental health issues more seriously, or the fact that Ron Artest just doesn't care what anybody thinks of him?
Ron Artest, I'm not sure if he represents anything. He's a singular character, and bless him for it. But no, I do think at some extent, clearly there's still a ways to go, but I do think that slowly, the sports world has sort of enlightened itself a little bit, probably still behind society at large. But I do think there is a bit of a growing awareness about mental illness in sports, in part because athletes are not remotely immune from this. And whether it's, Joey Votto, who's an MVP candidate in the National League, to Jennifer Capriati, I mean, a host of athletes have had these varying issues. And I think that slowly teams are realizing that there are injuries and there are reasons for not playing that can exist, even if there isn't an X-ray confirming it.
What are leagues and teams doing to address mental health concerns?
Well, there seems to be a huge continuum. Some teams are proactive and they have a sports psychologist on staff, and other teams, athletes have said, they've complained about it, and the response from management has been, well, go run it off. If you have depression, get on the treadmill and run the blues away. So I think it really varies. I mean, Major League Baseball has a policy now where teams can actually put an athlete on the disabled list with the psychological cause, which we never used to see. But I do think that it really is sort of a team-by-team thing. And some teams, Joey Votto, who I mentioned, who took a break from playing last year to deal with some anxiety issues, says the Reds couldn't have been more supportive. And, members of the organization said, look, I've got friends and family that deal with these issues. I have a sense of what you're going through. Take your time. And other athletes say that their organizations have very little clue.
Coaches like to praise the mental toughness of their athletes, but you suggest pro players might be more susceptible to mental illness than guys with desk jobs. Have you seen much evidence of that in your career covering sports?
Well, I haven't empirically. I mean, the National Institute for Mental Health will say that, at any given time, 25% of American adults suffer from a diagnosable mental illness. Certainly, you won't find that to be the case in sports, at least not publicly. But if you sort of look at the risk factors, you can just sort of go through the checklist, and especially with head injuries, sometimes accelerating mental illness, which obviously has been a hot topic lately in sports. There's no reason why athletes wouldn't suffer at the same rate as the general population. And in fact, if you look at some of these risk factors, it just stands to reason that they're probably more susceptible to mental illness.
And you also point out the extreme pressure that they're under.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's funny. After the story came out, I got a ton of mail, and some of it was very personal and very heartfelt. And other people said, pressure, try having your home foreclosed and trying to find a job in a state with 12% unemployment, these spoiled baby millionaires. But I think that sort of misses the definition of pressure, that you're out there, you're performing in front of millions of people, you have a very short career window, you're on the road, you have financial pressures in the sense that sometimes you've come into this vast wealth overnight, which can be, there's certain dissonance that goes with that. I mean, pressure is more than just figuring out how you're going to pay your mortgage. And I think if you talk about a stressful job, boy, you know, playing football with a chance for injury on every play and a very, very short career window and, you know, 80,000 people in the stands and your stats being there for everybody to assess how well you did your job, I think that's a huge pressure position.
Your article references a piece by one of your SI colleagues, which refers to Kansas City Royals pitcher Zach Greinke as the Jackie Robinson of mental illness. Do you think that's overstating it a bit?
Well, I mean, I think it's at some level, it sort of depends on how this continues to play out and what the legacy will be down the road. I mean, I use Jackie Robinson as a point of comparison at your own peril. Zach Greinke went on the disabled list. It was very clearly, you know, to deal with some anxiety and some depression issues, and he very readily admits that medication and antidepressants and therapy were the cause of his recovery. He comes back, he wins the Cy Young Award. It's sort of a non-issue. That's something you did not see a decade ago. In that same article, the pitcher for the Mets said, boy, I just wish I had been born 15 years later, because had I been able to have acceptance like Greinke had, I would have been able to continue my career. So the Jackie Robinson comparison by Mike Sweeney may be a bit extreme, but I do think it was really significant that we have an athlete who addressed this head on and didn't use some of the euphemisms, was very upfront about it, and returned to become, you know, the best pitcher in baseball.
As you've mentioned, there are a handful of athletes who've publicly admitted to struggling with mental illness. If depression and other illnesses are so common, why is it still so difficult for athletes to talk about them?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that is just sort of the culture, this macho culture of sport. I think, you know, there's still a lot of misunderstanding about mental illness. You know, the guy next to you in the locker room has shredded up his knee, and how dare you try to get out of practice or not play because you happen to be feeling low. It's a physical act that you're doing, playing a sport. So I think the notion is, as long as you're okay physically, well, you know, what's there to worry about?
John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. You can link to his article about athletes suffering from depression at our website, onlyagame.org. John, thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
The Pittsburgh Steelers are the fifth oldest NFL franchise, founded as the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1933. Today, the Steelers have six NFL championships to their credit, but it took them more than four decades to win their first title. The new book, The Ones Who Hit the Hardest, chronicles the team's dramatic rise in the 1970s and its legendary rivalry with the Dallas Cowboys. It also details the start of a long descent for Pennsylvania's steel industry. Joining me from NPR's New York Bureau are the co-authors, Chad Millman and Sean Coyne. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Chad, Dan Rooney began to take over the day-to-day operations of the Steelers from his father, Art Rooney Sr., in the late 1960s. What was the state of the team at that point?
Well, they were bad. They were really, really bad. The year that he hired his first coach, which was 1969, when he hired Chuck Knoll, the team had been 1-13. They were the worst team in the NFL. And in the 36 years they had been around prior to that, they had had 33 losing seasons. And Art Rooney was the guy who, when he saw the team in brand new uniforms and it was still playing horribly, His remark was, well, they have new uniforms, but they're still the same old Steelers. And that became sort of a mantra for fans throughout the region, that they were the same old Steelers, until Dan Rooney took over the team and hired Chuck Knoll, and sort of the dynasty began.
And Dan Rooney was an excellent high school football player. And football was really his love. And while his dad loved baseball, Dan Rooney just loved football. And in fact, he finished second for All-City to a guy named Johnny Unitas.
And tell the story about how the Steelers ended up cutting a young Johnny Unitas.
He was drafted to play for the Steelers. He was the fifth-string quarterback on the team as a rookie. And two of Art Rooney's kids were always on the field during training camp for the Steelers, and they always ended up being the ones who played catch with Johnny Unitas on the sidelines while the guys ahead of him took all the practice snaps with the first and second and third string teams. And they would see how good he was in comparison to all the guys that the Steelers had in the roster, and they wrote this impassioned letter to Art Rooney saying, you have to get Johnny Unitas more playing time. He is by far the best quarterback we have on this team. It's crazy that the coach isn't playing him. And he looked at the letter, looked at his boys, threw the letter away in a garbage can and said, it's the coach's job to decide who plays. I'm not getting in the middle of it. And that was his theory on the team. And you know, for better or for worse, that's how that's what happened to the Steelers for, you know, during his – when he was managing the team day to day. And mostly it was, unfortunately, for the Steelers fans, for worse.
Chad, you just have to consider Pittsburgh's team nickname to know Steel's important to the city. Describe a little bit about how life was in Pittsburgh when steel manufacturing was at its peak.
This was a city that was the hub of commerce for the United States. I mean, this is where every product that incorporated steel and iron was coming from. And you could actually see, you know, that the sky would rain black ash. I mean, even on the sunniest days, it was overcast with black ash and the remnants from the mills that were pumping out all this material and all these resources that were fueling the nation's economy. So there was a lot of pride wrapped up in what these guys were doing, and it was their life's work to work in these mills. It's what they had grown up to do. And so in the 70s, especially when the economy turned and the mills started to lose jobs, that was a blow, a huge psychological, emotional, financial blow. A lot of times when they were out of work, the only thing they had to look forward to was Sundays in Steeler football, especially as this team was becoming better and better. And in a lot of ways, embodying their lifestyle and what they believed in the way that this team played on the field.
Your book details the grueling work that goes into producing steel and contrasts the image of Pittsburgh's blue-collar population with Dallas's larger-than-life style, which is fueled by oil money. There's no question steelworkers have a brutally hard job, but weren't there plenty of Cowboys fans doing tough work in Texas's oil fields?
That's very true. And I think the initial fan base for the Dallas Cowboys was drawn from those oil workers. And the Cowboys initially played at the Cotton Bowl, which was in South Dallas, where a lot of the blue-collar workers worked. And they built their franchise on these guys who would go out and work a hard 40 to 50 hours a week and then go to the Cotton Bowl with a very reasonable ticket price, and they could go and see their Cowboys all the way through 1968. And what's interesting is the shift in Dallas from the blue-collar to the white-collar sensibility. And I think it mirrors the shift in the United States and the fall of our manufacturing base. So in 1968, very tellingly, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Clint Murchison Jr., decided, I'm going to make the greatest stadium possible, very similar to Jerry Jones today. And so what he did is he created Texas Stadium, and he put it in North Dallas, which was traditionally the place where the middle managers of Texas Instruments and the, you know, the foremen on the oil platforms would live. And he also divided the stadium into almost a hierarchy where, you know, people on the lower tiers of the stadium would have to pay expensive ticket prices. He was the first person to introduce personal seat licenses. So this all occurred in 1968. And once the Cowboys did move to Arlington, which is north of Dallas, all those folks in the South Dallas who were, you know, rabid Cowboy fans felt betrayed. So after you see the rise of the National Football League from, you know, in the 1970s, from sort of this, you know, football at, you know, the local stadium to these mega stadiums with these superstars, you can see that the Dallas Cowboys and Clint Murchison Jr. were really the forebears of that sensibility.
I'm speaking with Chad Millman and Sean Coyne, the authors of The Ones Who Hit the Hardest, and you're listening to Only a Game. The Steelers beat the Cowboys in Super Bowl X. Trash talk before a big game's a sports tradition, but how did these two teams end up despising each other so much?
Well, I think a large part of it was the difference in the way that they played. The Steelers specifically couldn't stand the way the Cowboys played. And the title of the book, The Ones Who Hit the Hardest, is actually a quote from Jack Lambert saying the game is won by the ones who hit the hardest. And it's in reference to the idea that he hated playing the Cowboys. He hated the way that their pants were shiny and their helmets were shiny and that they used a lot of schemes and trickery, and it never felt like you were being overpowered physically when you played against the Cowboys. And if they had beaten you, it wasn't because they played under the basic tenets of football, but because they sort of out-schemed you a little bit, and that just drove him nuts. And he was sort of at the pinnacle of all the Steelers hating the Cowboys because they were known as America's team in that mid-70s era, which was when the Steelers were winning the Super Bowls.
Sean, your book concludes with the Cowboys and the Steelers meeting in the Super Bowl again in 1979. You write, quote, "Super Bowl 13 would be what championships are supposed to be but rarely are, the two best teams playing at the highest levels with a hatred for each other." Just how good were those two teams?
Arguably, I would say that the Steelers of 1978 were at the pinnacle of their franchise. The Cowboys at the time were really superlative. They had great Hall of Fame players, and while there are great rivalries in the past, like the Packers and the Cowboys, or the Packers and the Bears, you never found that moment when you had these two powerhouse teams coming together at just that moment of perfect timing.
Well, you got to remember also, these were teams that the Steelers had won in 74. The Steelers had won in 75, and the Cowboys had won in 77, the year before these two teams met in that second Super Bowl. So this was their second Super Bowl against each other within 4 years. Those two Super Bowls they played, especially 13, were the epitome of what championships were supposed to be. Both games were won by a total of 8 points. They were by far the greatest Super Bowls that had been played up to that point.
Chad Millman and Sean Coyne are the authors of The Ones Who Hit the Hardest, The Steelers, The Cowboys, The 70s, and The Fight for America's Soul. They joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you both very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Cambridge, Massachusetts has long been recognized as a progressive city, but that perception is not shared by some motorists who have recently gotten parking tickets there. Cambridge has begun handing out parking tickets bearing yoga poses intended to calm violators. Artist Daniel Pelt says the 40,000 yoga tickets he designed are intended to debunk the idea that ticketing is a hostile exercise. But not all art collectors feel that way. One Cambridge resident tersely opined that there's no way to like it. Apparently, he didn't appreciate his ticket's so-called citation salutation. No truth to the rumor that Cambridge is considering the cat stretch and downward dog for violations of animal law ordinances.
To Harvard Square. To Harvard Square. To Harvard Square.
I'm Doug Tribou in for Bill Littlefield, who's in the Bay Area desperately trying to figure out how to work a GPS unit in time to find tomorrow's Women's Professional Soccer Championship match. Joining me now on the line is Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Doug.
On Thursday, Ichiro Suzuki became the first major leaguer ever to post 10 straight 200-hit seasons. Pete Rose also has 10, but they were non-consecutive. Too bad Ichiro plays for such a lousy team, huh?
Well, he didn't always play for a lousy team, but the team is pretty lousy now. The basic problem with this, of course, is that he's played in the Pacific time zone, but he's going to retire as really one of the great players of the last 30 years.
With just over a week to go in the MLB regular season, there are two divisional races of note. The Yankees are in a tight struggle with Tampa Bay for the AL East, while Saints Diego and Francisco are duking it out for the NL West. Any predictions in either of those races?
Yeah, I think Tampa may catch the Yankees, and I think that San Diego is going to hold on in the National League West. The Yankees are staggering a little bit now. I mean, they and the Rays played a brilliant series just finished, and now the Yankees are playing the Red Sox. I think the Yankees are going to fall to Tampa Bay because the Red Sox screw them up, to be honest with you.
In college football action, top-ranked Alabama will be at Arkansas today to take on the 10th-ranked Razorbacks. And the number 24 Oregon State Beavers will try to eke out a win on number 3 Boise State's psychedelic blue turf. What games will you be watching?
Well, I'm interested in Alabama and Arkansas because Alabama looks better than they did last year when they won the national championship. And the other game is interesting because it's really the last game that Boise State should have a chance of losing for the rest of the year. And they could wind up undefeated and just mired in third place because their kickoff win against Virginia Tech has become devalued because Virginia Tech can't beat anybody.
Wednesday's Philadelphia Daily News front cover depicted Eagles newly minted number 1 quarterback Michael Vick, along with the headline, Top Dog. You're a newspaper man from way back. Would you have gone with that headline?
I think I would stay away from anything canine in relation to Michael Vick in perpetuity. I think I know what the Daily News was going for, and unfortunately, I think they got it.
Buffalo Bills safety Donte Whitner said this week that he's tired of losing and of being laughed at by opponents while he's on the field. He accuses Green Bay and New England of being particularly disrespectful. Have you any advice for the disgruntled Buffalonian?
Yeah, play better. I mean, you play better, people won't laugh at you. I wonder if this is a league-wide problem. I think this is something Commissioner Goodell should look into. People are not working and playing well with others.
One of your favorite NBA head coaches will apparently be without a job this season. The Golden State Warriors will reportedly sever ties with Don Nelson. Is this the way to treat the league's winningest coach?
No, but I think this may be the end of the trail for Don Nelson, who's had a great, if uncontaminated by NBA championships, career, and is on his way to the Hall of Fame. It's interesting that Keith Smart looks like he's going to be the replacement. Keith Smart's previous glory moment in basketball, of course, was actually winning a national championship for Indiana.
NBA Commissioner David Stern considers Gilbert Arenas to be in good standing with the league after serving a nearly 3-month-long suspension without pay. But he gave Arenas express orders not to talk about the gun incident this season. I suppose because he's concerned Arenas would shoot his mouth off. What do you think?
Oh, I see what you did there. I noticed that. I think this is one of those things where you tell Gilbert, look, you get one time around the league, talk about it, and then it's over. You know, not having him not talk about it from jump, I don't think is going to be an effective strategy because Gilbert Arenas can't keep his mouth shut on anything.
The NHL preseason has begun, and it would appear the league has found a way to boost its television ratings. The HBO reality series titled 24/7 will feature Pittsburgh and Washington as they gear up for their Winter Classic on January 1st. It worked out for the NFL's Jets. How could it work out for hockey?
Well, they're very smart. They picked the two most glamorous teams in the NHL because they picked the two teams with the two most glamorous players, Sidney Crosby on Pittsburgh and Alex Ovechkin on Washington. So I'm sure that, you know, I mean, it might have been better to have, you know, Calgary and Phoenix, but I think they made the right move.
Charlotte Motor Speedway will install the world's largest video board in April. It's uncertain whether folks in Dallas will be able to see it on a clear day, but this has to steam Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, don't you think?
Yeah, but he's stuck. He can't make it any bigger because the one he's got in his stadium is already getting in the way. So, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, he's gonna have to admit that NASCAR's got him on this one.
Whether or not Bill makes it to tomorrow's WPS final between FC Gold Pride and the Philadelphia Independents, the game will take place, but there's once again speculation that women's pro soccer is about to go belly up. Does this strike you as a league with 9 lives, or do you think it will go the way of the WUSA?
I think that this league is finished. Sadly, I don't know that anyone will ever find a market for it. First, it's, you know, I mean, mass marketing women's sports is a tough sell in the United States, and mass marketing soccer of any kind is a tough sell. So, yeah, I think that WPS is probably over after the championship game.
In your Boston Globe blog this week, you wrote about Philippe Croizon, who on Sunday swam the English Channel in 13 and a half hours, which is impressive enough on its own, but Mr. Croizon is a quadruple amputee. This puts many other athletic achievements into perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, because this is one of those things that sort of stays iconic even in the age where we're incredibly unimpressed by almost everything. Swimming the English Channel is still a big deal, and doing it the way this guy did, I don't know what you can say except stand up and cheer for the guy.
And finally, Charlie, a Finnish lass has caught the attention of yoga buffs, not just because of her superb form and unquestioned fitness, but also because she's a brown bear living at the Atari Zoo. They really ought to name a move after her.
Yeah, I think that, well, first of all, no one's going to laugh at, you know, people get kind of chuckle at people doing yoga in the park. No one's going to laugh at a bear. And secondly, I think that, you know, the Earth sign Lotus is probably a position we should all adopt for our own relaxation purposes.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine and joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Doug.
Babe Ruth, 2 feet by 3 feet. Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, 2 feet by 3 feet. Mickey Mantle, you guessed it, 2 feet by 3 feet. George Steinbrenner, 5 feet by 7 feet. That's the size of the boss's new memorial in Yankee Stadium's Monument Park. The massive plaque mounted on a pink granite base was unveiled Monday night. The Yankees have honored many of the notable figures in team history. There are monuments for the aforementioned players, plus one for the manager of New York's first three championship teams, Miller Huggins. There's also a monument honoring the September 11th victims and rescue workers. And there are smaller plaques for other players, managers, announcers, and even two popes. But Steinbrenner's dwarfs them all. Asked if the boss would have liked that, Yankee captain Derek Jeter replied, "No question. It was probably his idea." Steinbrenner died July 13th at the age of 80. With his big spending and even bigger talking, he made himself the story, battled his superstars and managers in the press, and earned two suspensions from baseball along the way. In his 37 years as the principal owner, the Bronx Bombers won 7 World Series. No small feat, but by my count, that leaves 20 titles that happened when Steinbrenner wasn't in charge. The last sentence on Steinbrenner's massive plaque says his personal motto was, quote, "The greatest form of charity is anonymity." To be fair, Steinbrenner's generosity was notable and often hidden from the public eye. But using the word anonymity on a 760-pound memorial is about as subtle as turning your NBA free agent signing announcement into an hour-long TV special. Not that anyone would ever be that arrogant. Former Yankee captain and current Dodger coach Don Mattingly flew back to New York for the ceremony. Mattingly already has a plaque in Monument Park, and his number is retired. His career included just one playoff appearance and 0 World Series victories. Yet when he walked on the field for the ceremony, Yankees fans gave him some of the loudest cheers of the night. There's no question Steinbrenner deserves a spot among the premier pinstripers, but Jerry Jones and Mark Cuban take note. No matter how much the camera's on the owner, in the end, fans really care about the players.
From coast to coast, that's all you'll hear of Joe, the one-man show. He's glorified the horse I'd fear, Jolting Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio, we want you on our side.
Tomorrow in Hayward, California, the Philadelphia Independents and FC Gold Pride will contend for the Women's Professional Soccer Championship, amid speculation that the league may soon fold. The WPS lost its Los Angeles and St. Louis franchises this year and has recently faced declining attendance and sponsorship. By contrast, Major League Soccer's average attendance now exceeds that of the NBA and the NHL, with the Seattle Sounders drawing an amazing 36,000 per home game and Toronto FC over 20,000. Toronto FC proved just how viable a Canadian MLS team can be when it joined the league 4 years ago. And starting next season, the Vancouver Whitecaps FC will join the league, followed by the Montreal Impact in 2012. What will 3 Major League Soccer teams mean for the sport in Canada and beyond? Only a game Sean Cole is in Toronto, and we asked him to kick that question around for us.
There's this amazing thing that happens at every Toronto FC home game. Hundreds of Uber fans, a.k.a. supporters, gather in the far corners of BMO Stadium and chant and sing and play drums for the entire match, no matter what's happening on the field. They've got a huge repertoire of songs. Some of them are TFC-themed versions of other songs.
Forever we love you so. All of the highs and lows. This is a
Believe it or not, this has really contributed to the popularity of Toronto FC, which reliably sells out its matches at home. And Bob Leonarduzzi, the president of the Vancouver Whitecaps FC, has taken note.
I talk to people from Toronto who go to games, and I say, oh, so you're a soccer fan. They say, well, we're getting to be. And I say, okay, well, then why are you going? And they say, we just love the atmosphere. We love being a part of the crowd.
It's an atmosphere he wants to emulate as he retools the Whitecaps from a Division II United States Soccer Federation team into an MLS franchise. And even though these Canadian teams will soon be league rivals, the Toronto club has been more than happy to consult with Vancouver, and Montreal too, with all sorts of advice and support. Leonarduzzi says Toronto's success is a key reason for the other two teams joining the fold.
Had Toronto struggled, I don't think there would have been further expansion into Canada. So we owe them in that I think that they've paved the way. But having said that, once we play that first game on the field, it's all over.
It's such an interesting schizophrenia of, like, using them as a model, them having a kind of cuddly relationship mm-hmm. with them from a business perspective.
Yes.
And then, but we will crush them.
I don't want to say we'll crush them, but we want to win, and they'll want to win.
I would absolutely agree that I will not take it lightly, and we absolutely will squash them. Thank you for teeing that up.
Paul Byrne is the Senior Director of Business Operations for Toronto FC. He says having MLS competition in Canada will really stretch all of these teams.
It'll make everybody better, from the players to the coaches to the referees to the front offices. Everyone across the board will get better as a result of this.
Is there any sort of hazing ritual that you guys have with each other?
No.
Bringing new teams in the fold? You have a paddle?
No, we just make them write a big check.
A $40 million check, which is one of two financial requirements for entry into the league. The other's a stadium plan. Beyond the economics, though, expansion in Canada might mean Canadian teams are actually taken seriously in the U.S., at least if they do well. Bo Duer is the author of Long Range Goals, the success story of Major League Soccer.
It seems like the only time American sports fans get a little bit of a complex on their own part about Canadian teams is when Canadian teams lift the trophy. I remember the Toronto Blue Jays winning the World Series, and that caused great consternation in the U.S. And so it'll be interesting to see if that dynamic comes into play when a Canadian team advances.
And this leads to another kind of schizophrenia among the Canadians. Sure, Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal are all going to want to beat each other, but they also want the country to advance on the world soccer stage. And in a way, this means being unified toward a collective goal. Again, Paul Byrne.
I mean, I'm a Canadian. I have a maple leaf on my heart.
Literally tattooed on your heart?
Not literally, figuratively. And as a result, I want our national team to do well as Toronto FC. And the most fundamental way in which we hope to see our impact come to fruition is to see Canada qualify at the Men's World Cup.
Which it hasn't done since 1986, the only year it qualified. But that's not to say Canada doesn't get to play international teams, particularly within CONCACAF, the Confederation of North, Central American, and Caribbean Association Football. I went to a CONCACAF Champions League match between Toronto and the Mexican team Cruz Azul in mid-August and brought my friend Dominic along.
Come on!
Dominic Girard. He's Canadian, and he has a theory about Canada and the World Cup. The year his nation fields a team, he says, is the year it'll be truly unified.
Because we live in a country of diversity, right? And everybody feels that they're in a country where you can pledge allegiance to your home team. And so there's no incentive to pledge allegiance to a Canadian team.
Right, exactly.
Okay. So the day we have a Canadian team in the World Cup is the day that we know the country's come together as its own identity.
And that might sound grand, but in Toronto at least, the question around World Cup time is always, who are you backing?
In the World Cup, Dutch. They play great. I'm half Dutch. There you go.
Italy.
Why Italy?
I'm half Italian.
I back France because I like a roller coaster with my emotions.
This last guy is Mike Langevin, a member of the Red Patch Boys, the supporters group you heard singing earlier. I caught up with him at their headquarters, a bar, with Toronto FC banners hanging from the ceiling. He and the others were getting ready for an MLS game against the New York Red Bulls.
And we're going to give them a whole lot of stick. You know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean. What is stick?
Grief. I'm keeping it PG for the moment, but it won't be PG in the stadium.
But it's all in good fun in the end, he says. He and his buddies just love the rivalry. And so when the other two Canadian teams join the league, he's looking forward to giving them a whole lot of stick, too.
The timing is just right in Canada for soccer. Toronto's proven that with Toronto FC. Montreal's got a great thing going over there. You know, I hate their guts. They're a terrible team. I wish them all broken legs, but I'm very happy they're in the league because it means we're going to get to play them, and we're going to send 3,000 people down the 401, down the highway, and we're going to go and visit them en masse, and it's going to be great.
Of course, it could also be really, really disheartening.
2-0 New York.
As it was during the Red Bulls game.
And the only reason is because, well, we're not playing very well.
Stephanie Rhea is another Red Patch boy, or girl. I caught up with her at halftime. And while she wasn't in too good a mood, she perked up when I asked her about the MLS expansion.
Vancouver, Montreal, us, we're going to be able to draft other players. And football, I call it football, I don't call it soccer. The more I get into it, the more I really want it to just grow so that it's everywhere, so that we have a team in Hamilton, we have a team in Niagara, we have a team in Ottawa, so that we can just compete with everybody. I don't like waiting for the World Cup every 4 years. It sucks.
And that's a major point. Yes, Canadians can get their soccer yayas out every 4 years, but there's a growing lust for the sport up here that wants to be fulfilled, which means a more than viable market for big league teams. And with the coming expansion, the lustful might one day see a Canadian team conquer the North American game. And who knows, maybe even the world. For Only a Game, I'm Sean Cole.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Baltimore Orioles manager Buck Showalter, who expresses relief at having left his previous gig as an ESPN baseball analyst.
Live TV was tough, really cramped your language.
That's certainly a lot tougher than enduring a 162-game regular season. Then again, live broadcasts didn't always motivate Earl Weaver to practice self-censorship. I'm Doug Tribou. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from PBS, presenting Baseball, the 10th Inning, from Ken Burns, premieres Tuesday, September 28th at 8, 7 Central on most PBS stations. The Kauffman Foundation, educating entrepreneurs about how to start and grow businesses through Kauffman Fast Track at fasttrack.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.